Thanks very much. Yeah, that was a. In some ways, that's going to be a tricky Bible reading. There's a few words there with some a whole bunch of syllables squeezed together in Greek there. So you did very well. It's great to be with you, and also great to join you on this what is Father's Day. And so, happy Father's Day to all the fathers who join us. And one of the ways you've come up with a way maybe to rattle or needle the guest speaker, and that's to tell them that the person coming next week has published a book. And so as I come to you, I haven't written a book or a pamphlet or even a monograph, but I've written some long emails, so hopefully that's sufficient for some. I don't know if you've ever been in those times when you realize that you're not necessarily the sharpest person in the room. And maybe for some of that happens at higher frequency than others. But I remember back at university days, you know, I had a friend. His name was Jeff Martin, and I'm happy to drop his full name. It was a long time ago, and it's a pretty general sort of name. But Jeff was, we did math together, and he was really the sharpest cookie in the class. And he won something called the university medal. And all that really means is that he got perfect grades right throughout his university degree. He didn't drop a single mark. He was just the sharpest guy in the room. A lovely guy. We used to hang out together a little bit socially. But occasionally, he was the smartest person in the room until he wasn't. And so we'd be at the football, and we'd buy our hot dogs and our chips. And Jeff Martin, he'd be there with one of those little sauce satchels that you had to squeeze together with your finger and your thumb. And he'd look at me and he said, "John, how on earth does this thing work? I can't figure it out." And so this guy who had such lofty ideas and brilliance with mathematics, he could not operate the tomato sauce. And when Jeff was in school, they used to try and haze him. They'd say, "Jeff, we're on a school camp. They're boiling water." And they used to say to Jeff, "Make sure you keep stirring the water so it doesn't stick to the bottom of the pan." And half an hour later, Jeff would still be there stirring, you know. And so sometimes that's the case, isn't it? The sharpest people in the room, they can sometimes miss things, really key things. And for my friend Jeff Martin, there were sort of trivial things, but sometimes we can miss some really important things. And so as Paul goes into Athens, he's surrounded by these people who are intellectual and very sharp, and yet they have missed something very key. The book of Acts 17, verse 16. I'm excited to hear it as a church. We've been journeying through the book of Acts, and I hope you've been enjoying that. But the first verse there we read says, "While Paul was waiting for them in Athens, he was greatly distressed to see that the city was full of idols." And so I picture myself, even today going to Athens, I imagine I would just be bowled away by the architecture and by these, you know, Corinthian columns, and to be awestruck, this place, the birthplace of democracy, the birthplace of philosophy, I might feel quite intimidated. It's kind of like walking onto a Harvard or a Cambridge, or even when I moved out here for the first time to the West, even walking onto the hallowed turf of the University of Western Australia, I'd sometimes look around and I'd feel intimidated. But it's interesting, as Paul visits Athens and he walks the streets, what he's really struck by is that they're saturated by idols. It's this city saturated with idols. He's puzzled by this altar, which is dedicated to the unknown God. So Paul is this man, he's assessing what is going on, not in terms of the categories of what is respectable to the world, but he's assessing things in terms of the reality of God's truth being made known and clear to these people. And so what's happening in Athens is actually not that different to some of the worldview that we might experience here today in the Southwest. So firstly, some of the things going on in Athens, there is this religious or cultural pluralism. And so what pluralism is, that's just a fancy word that says it's okay to have a God, but just don't go about telling us that he is true, because we have all these other gods. And it's a bit arrogant to us to say that in this entire pantheon of gods or worldviews that one of them is true. And then you've got this other thing called self-indulgence. And what self-indulgence says is, sure, you can have a faith, but at the end of the day, what really matters is your comfort and your security. That's the thing you should seek. And in Athens, I tell you, if you desired, you know, a safe passage on the high seas, you would pray to the god of Neptune. Or if you were looking to experience a Valentine's Day to remember, or to hit things off romantically with someone you were fond of, you would seek the god Aphrodite, the god of love. A buffet banquet of gods serving their every need, whim, and desire. So you got pluralism, you got self-indulgence. That also leads to something called secularism. And so secularism is really saying, you know, you can, sure, you can have a god or a faith, but ultimately you keep that away from others, you compartmentalize it. It's a bit like you've got a wallet and a photo of your family or something. You can take your religion, put it in your wallet, and maybe bring it out on a Sunday or once a week at the prayer meeting. But it doesn't affect the entire totality of your life, of your being. And so you see this Athenian worldview, it's actually not that different to a lot of the similar worldview that we have, or that our neighbors have in this world today. And so finding himself in Athens and stacked with these very impressive people, Paul remains distinctly unimpressed. You see, he's looking upon Athens with this different set of goggles. We see this different mindset, this different set of goggles. We see that a bit with Jesus as well. As he makes his way to Jerusalem, he looks around, and Jerusalem is this bustling city. It's got this incredible religious heritage. But as he looks with spiritual eyes, with this different lens, it says in Matthew's gospel, when he saw the crowds in Jerusalem, he had compassion on them because they were harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. And so we see Jesus can see at this piercing depth what is really going on in the soul of these people that he is in proximity to. I don't know, perhaps if you've ever been around people like that, it's like as they're looking at you, they can see right through our bluff. So in response, Paul becomes greatly distressed, and he feels this mixture of revulsion. This revulsion that God and God's truth and the holiness of God has been eroded or ignored, dishonored. But he also has this compassion towards those who are enslaved by this system of idols. And so one Christian author might describe this term as, it's a holy discontent. It's a holy discontent. And this distress, he doesn't just stay in a distress, but it moves him to action and to do something. And so that's just to begin with, you know, as followers of Jesus this morning and in Margaret River, as we go about our lives, perhaps as we mix with our neighbours, do we experience that same stirring that Paul felt, where there's this holy discontent? As we hear neighbours talk and they reflect on life and purpose and death, and we hear sometimes how muddled it has all become, does that drive us to a discontent? You know, if we don't, if there's none of that fire burning in the belly, or if there's nothing there, it perhaps it could be that sometimes we're drinking from that same fountain of culture and belief as those around us. And even just this morning, you know, perhaps taking a moment just to examine our own hearts, are there some idols that are drawing us to them? Things we keep clutching onto in our lives, things other than God that we depend upon. And so idols here today, they're no longer the Old Testament type where they're confined maybe to someone's lounge room. You know, if you invite me for lunch, I don't expect to see a golden cow on your mantelpiece. I might see a St. Kilda scarf or something, but not a golden cow. So Tim Keller, he explains idols. He says, anything more important to you than God. Anything that absorbs your heart and imagination more than God. And I tell you, they're not even always bad things. Something like leisure, that leisure's not a bad thing. It's just it's a good thing. And often in life, the good things become the enemy to the best things. And so idols, what they do is they compromise our intimacy and our devotion to God. And they become, for all practical purposes, they become our functional saviour, our go-to for comfort or to security or for validation. And so perhaps Paul visiting Athens in that first verse, perhaps there's something there for us. It's just this reminder. It's not lost on me that today it's the first day of spring. And so spring, you know, it's also the first day of the rest of our lives. And so just as we do spring cleaning, and we probably don't just do it one Saturday, we probably do it successive Saturdays. Maybe it's just that gentle prodding from the Spirit to be examining our own lives and decluttering our lives from idols. Paul is not impressed, he's depressed, but it moves him to an action, to act and to proclaim. Let's move on a little bit to just some of the things that Paul is saying here. It's interesting in this passage. Paul begins in the Jewish synagogue, as is usual or custom, but he also goes to the marketplace, and that's something that's a bit different. And this, in the marketplace, this sparks an interest from those who are listening, and they invite him on to this place called the Areopagus, which is where it's a supreme council in Athens, where a lot of the new ideas or new philosophies are discussed. And so it's really that place, these guys sitting on the Areopagus, they have the power to propel or promote some of these new ideas, or they can put on sanctions, they can curb it, and it can stop right there. And so in a sense, in Acts 17 here, we have Paul's, one of his greatest opportunities for Christianity to spread throughout the empire. You know, it's almost like his real TED Talk type moment. And it takes courage. I don't watch a lot of ABC's Q&A, but I just know occasionally I see clips of, you know, Christians when they go on there. And it's almost like Daniel in the lion's den. You know, there's all these people against their worldview and they're asking them questions. And I wonder if that's a little bit what it's like at the Areopagus. He's talking to Greeks, and these Greeks people, they don't have the same background in understanding Jewish thinking or Judaism as the rest of those he speaks to. And so they don't know the law or the prophets. And so what he does here is he starts his message much, much further back in terms of their understanding. And so that's actually helpful for us, because often as we connect with our neighbors and we're sharing a message, often we these days we have to start further and further back in this world that is becoming a bit more post-Christian in culture, but pre-Christian in understanding and understanding of the Bible. We've got to start further and further back. And that's why it's great to hear, as a church, you're doing the Alpha course. You know, continue to promote that and invite along friends, because Alpha does a great job at starting all the way back from the beginning. It's said that Paul's message, from verse 24 onwards, one author describes him as talking about these 17 truths of who God is. And I'm not going to go through each of the 17, but just to say there's a lot of depth there in terms of who he is, this God he is drawing attention to. He starts with God as the creator, and then he works his way through to Jesus before finishing with a challenge. It's actually a really gutsy message as he seizes this opportunity to share with an otherwise very proud people. But he does so in a way that actually respects their intellect. He wants to win them by the force of his message. He doesn't start by goading them about all of their gods or their deception. So firstly, he talks about who God is, God's nature. And so Christian author A.W. Tozer, he says, you know, the most important thing about any person, any man, any woman, is what comes into their minds when they think about God. That's the most important thing about someone. And so Paul understands this, and he starts talking about, he says, the God I am telling you about, he is not confined to these temples or shrines. He's far too wonderful. He's far too powerful for that. He created the universe. We don't create a space for him. He has created a space for us. And he sustains and provides for our lives. You know, he's not dependent on us, but we remain utterly dependent on him. God doesn't need us to bring him a meat pie. The Bible says, the psalmist says, he owns the cattle on a thousand hills. And whatever else goes into a meat pie, he owns that too. And he knows about that too, and often we don't know about it. Some Eastern countries, what they do even to this day is they put out food for their gods. And so in a sense, you know, how small must their gods be? You've got to feed them every day or they're going to die. And Paul says, let's not try to do that to God. Let's not domesticate him. He is far too big for that. He goes on to say God rules the nations. All people everywhere are from one person. So in that sense, we're all family. To believe in the fatherhood of God is to believe in this brotherhood of humanity. The history of every nation is under his control. And Paul, what he's doing is he's showing these guys that they are limiting God. They're trying to contain him. They're trying to localize him, trying to make him so much smaller than he is. And so that's the beginning. That's the first part of his message, talking about God's nature, his attributes. But secondly, he goes on to talk about God's desire to know us. He is a personal God. Just a few verses says, God did this so they would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he is not far from any one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being. As some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring. Therefore, since we are God's offspring, we should not think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image made by human design and skill. So again, not only is God incredibly powerful, he is also incredibly personal. And so he's acting and revealing his character in the world in such a way that we, here in Margaret River, that we might know him. He is not remote or somewhere out there, totally distant from us, passive. He's our Father. He made us, and because of that, he owns us. He wants us to see that we too can belong in his family. And so Paul, he goes on to quote some poets. He quotes a gentleman, Erastus, who says, we are his offspring. Recently, there's been, maybe in the last 10, 15 years, this movement known as intelligent design. And what intelligent design says is that if you look at the intricacy of life through the lens of science, what you can see there is the fingerprint of a creator, a fingerprint of an intelligent designer. Somebody out there created this. This whole thing didn't just happen by chance. And that's not a bad argument, but this is saying, what Paul's saying is God is more than just this wonderful designer. The point Paul makes is that he's a loving father, desiring to help us know him personally. He wants us to reach out. He wants us to find him because he is not far from us. And just to appreciate that every tiny detail of our lives is under his supervision and control because he cares that much about us. And then he quotes this other poet, Epimenides, who says, we live and move and have our being. And so the Greek poet was referring to his god, Zeus, but Paul is using it here to refer to the living God. In him we live and move and have our being. And so there's things you can learn here from what Paul is saying as he declares about this majestic and wonderful God. But I tell you what, as you read between some of the lines, you can also see there's things here to learn about just Paul's method and how he speaks to people. And so you'll see here as he quotes different poets, he's understanding their culture and their literature and their arts. He's learning this language of how to speak to these philosophically minded people. But, you know, I tell you, he's not doing that to impress them with knowledge. He's doing that to try and win them over to Jesus. He wants them to see the difference between their gods and his God, the creator who wants to have relationship with his creation. And so theologians might use some fancy words to describe some of this dynamic that Paul talks about. And so you've really got the transcendence of God. See, God is so powerful and so far beyond us, But yet there's also the imminence of God. He is near to us. He knows the hair on our heads. Perhaps that's a message for us this morning, just the encouragement. Maybe the first day of spring is about getting over a winter. And sometimes that season of winter in life can involve a discontent and a feeling that we don't matter to God. But, you know, this morning I just want to affirm and encourage you that God sees you. He is not far from each one of us. In the 1950s in Perth, Perth became known as the City of Light. Perhaps some of you have heard the story or you participated yourself in this, but the idea of a US astronaut, John Glenn, who was circumnavigating an astronaut out in space. And because Perth is such an isolated city, the idea was, hey, if everyone turns on their street lights, if everyone lights a candle, all together we can be seen by this astronaut. And it actually, functionally, they needed to do it so this astronaut had a bearing. You know, he could see where he was in relation to the planet. It's this idea of, hey, if all of us put our lights on, we can be seen by this being who is so far beyond us. But, you know, God is so much greater than this astronaut. He is so much more powerful and sovereign and beyond the astronaut. And yet, you know, we don't have to all coalesce together and put these lights on at the same time for him to notice us. We don't have to assemble in a group. It's this sense of, it's personal. He sees us. He sees us. He knows us. He knows the hair on our heads. Today is, it's Father's Day. It's just that encouragement that there is a loving Father who desires to know you personally, this God who is beyond us, yet wants to know us. And how does he do it? What is his avenue for doing it? Well, it's he sent his son. And so Paul finishes, just as I finish shortly, Paul goes on to zero in on God's judgment through Jesus. And so the point here is clear, and that's if God is our creator, he has this right to tell us how to live our lives. He determines right and wrong. He sets the standard. And he has this authority. He has this authority to hold us to those standards. And so even these bright sparks, even those intellectuals listening that day were under God's authority and they had no excuse. The day is coming when God is going to be our judge. Thankfully, he's going to judge us with justice, but he is going to do that through Jesus, the one he has raised from the dead. A day is determined, and only God himself knows that day, when judgment will take place. And ignorance actually won't cut it, especially as we understand that God is the one who made a way for us to be right through Jesus. The resurrection of Jesus from the dead, what that does is that guarantees for those who believe in him, they have a forgiveness from sin and they get to live for eternity with God. That is the good news. And it's interesting, you think of Paul building bridges and he starts with common ground and he's respectful and he remains respectful. But I tell you what, he still, at the end of his message, he still shares things, what I would call uncomfortable truths. To talk to people about a resurrection or a judgment, those are difficult things for Australians to hear. I imagine they were very difficult things for these Athenians to hear as well. And yet Paul was truthful with them. He was truthful in love. What was their response? Well, some mocked, some sneered. You see people calling him a babbler. There's some criticism. Reluctance. Others said, you know, we're interested. We'd like to hear you again in this matter. That's another encouragement to keep trying to promote that alpha course. You know, there are people out there in this community with questions. But finally, there was repentance. Some, not a huge number, but they could name them by name. And the fact their names are known, there's probably some significant people there, perhaps even people in the Areopagus who took this message and became disciples. Some joined him and believed. I hope There's something there in Acts 17, Paul's wonderful visit to Athens, declaring this wonderful God to a strange or a new type of people. I hope there's something in that passage today, either to sharpen us and or encourage us. Thank you very much.
Thank you, John. Maybe if we all turn on the light in our lives in Margaret River, we can light up the darkness here, the most godless community in Australia, according to the census.